Psalm 107, 23 and 24. They that go down to the sea in ships, that do business in great waters, these see the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep. The natural wonders of the great lakes. Now, the psalmist, I'm sure, was probably thinking about the Mediterranean Sea. But those verses apply very well to the Great Lakes. They are seas. In introduction here, I'd like to look at just some facts that are wonderful to think about. And then I'll look a little bit at a few of the islands, just introduce some. And then a little at the ecology of the Great Lakes, and finally, how the Great Lakes affect the weather and the regions around them. One of the most outstanding features of the Great Lakes is their great size. But guess what? Russia has us beat again for size of lake, at least in volume. The largest lake in the world, freshwater lake, Lake Baikal, is in Russia, and it holds more water than all of the Great Lakes combined. Having said that, how much water is in the Great Lakes? The Great Lakes contain more than 20% of the world's fresh water, or 80% of the fresh water in North America. Approximately 6 quadrillion gallons of water. That's a 6 followed by 15 zeros. If you would take the water in the Great Lakes and spread it out over the contiguous 48 states of the United States, it would cover it to a depth of about 9.5 feet. Lake Superior is superior in size. It holds more water than the other four Great Lakes combined. And if you would, there's enough water in Lake Superior to cover all of North and South America with about 1 foot of water. When I read that, I couldn't believe it. But if you have your handouts and you can look at the volume of Lake Superior, 2,935 cubic miles, and I'm just going to give you North America's covers 9,355,000 square miles, and South America's 6,878,000 square miles, and if you do the math, that works out. Another interesting feature on the Great Lakes is retention time. That is the time it takes for a lake to move pollutants through or out of it, or the average time a given particle will stay in the system. So again, those times are on your handouts for each lake. I found sources varied somewhat. Lake Superior retention time is anywhere from 191 years. Lake Michigan, 62 to 69 years. Lake Huron, 21 to 22 years. Lake Erie, 2.6 to 2.7 years. And Lake Ontario, 6 years. And then thinking about the coastline. The combined coastline of the Great Lakes is 10,200 miles. And if you, for comparison, just looked up, I was trying to find another country to compare with, and China's coastline is 9,100 miles. And if you include all the islands of the Great Lakes, the coastline becomes 10,900 miles. And just for interest's sake, 80% of US coastline is privately owned, and 20% of Canadian is in private ownership. Islands. The Great Lakes have about 35,000 islands scattered throughout them. Now, most of these islands are on the east side of the Georgian Bay in a string 200 kilometers long that is called the 30,000 Islands. And coincidentally, that is the world's largest freshwater archipelago. Archipelago. Now, thinking about islands. Lake Superior. The Madeline Island is the largest of the Apostle Islands. It's a group of 22 islands off of Bayfield Peninsula, northern Wisconsin. And it is the only island in the Apostle Islands that is developed, 14 miles long, 3 miles wide, with a population of 302. It's accessible by ferry from Bayfield or by ice when conditions allow. It has a long history. It was inhabited by Native Americans for hundreds of years, and later by fur traders and missionaries for over 400 years. It has flown the flags of France, Great Britain, and the US. It was named after Madeline Cadott, which was the daughter of an Ojibwe chief who had married a prominent French fur trader. One of the outstanding features in the Apostles Islands is sea caves, and I'll have a picture of that in your handout. Sea caves are caused primarily by wave action. They're located in different areas throughout the world along coastlines. Lake Michigan's largest island is Beaver Island. It's in the northern part of the lake. It's 55.8 square miles, 13 miles long, and 3 to 6 miles wide. And it has a resident population of 657 in 2010. That was the latest statistic I could get for that one. It also has an interesting history. In 1848, it became the home to a unique religious colony, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Only this was a breakaway group from Joseph Young, and it had a self-appointed leader who was called King Strang. Strang was a very quarrelsome fellow, and he eventually was murdered, and his group was expelled from the island in 1856. Manitou Island is the largest island, freshwater island in the world, northern part of Lake Huron. It covers 1,068 square miles, and it even has inland lakes itself. The largest is Lake Manitou, which covers 40 square miles. I didn't say how many lakes it has. It has 108 lakes. This island has 108 lakes. And has a resident population of 13,255 in 2016. Flowerpot Island. How many have been there? All right. So we're quite familiar with that island in Georgian Bay. Our school went there, our classroom upper grades went there on a class trip last year. Enjoyed that. Flower Pot Island's name comes from two rock pillars on the northern shore, which look like flower pots. It used to have three. One of them tumbled in 1903. One of the interesting features on that island was another sea cave. And those that have been there know what I'm talking about. And it's interesting how high that sea cave was, wasn't it? You had to hike up quite a ways, and it's at least 70 feet above the current water level. I'm thinking that's a very conservative figure. So what happened? Was the water level used to be that high, or did it get thrust up? I guess I'll let you decide that. But it's there. Mackinac Island, another island in Lake Huron. It's not a very large island, 4.35 square miles, with a resident population of 583 in 2020. It too was an important French fur trading location. And British took possession of this island after the French and Indian War, built a fort on it during the American Revolutionary War. It was the site of two battles during the War of 1812, and the British retained possession of it, but later they gave it to the Americans when it was decided where the border was. So it's part of in the United States today. It is a tourist attraction and receives tens of thousands of visitors annually. At the end of the 1800s, motor vehicles were restricted on the island because of concerns for health and safety of the residents. And the locals were complaining about the noise and how the automobiles startled their horses. And so a ban was put on motor vehicles, and that ban continues to the present day. There is an exception made for city emergency and service vehicles. Coming down to Lake Erie. Lake Erie's largest island is Pelee Island. It holds the distinction of being the southernmost populated point in Canada, with a population in 2021 of 230. It covers 16 square miles. It's also a famous island for birders because it is situated on two main North American migratory bird routes, the Atlantic Flyway and the Mississippi Flyway converge over that point. So it's a good place for viewing birds. Another island in Lake Erie is Johnson Island, which is in the southern part of Lake Erie. It's a 300-acre island, about 3 miles from the city of Sandusky, Ohio. It was made the site of a prisoner of war camp for Confederate officers captured during the American Civil War. Then later it held privates and political prisoners and persons that were sentenced to court-martial and also spies. More than 15,000 men were incarcerated there during its 3 years of operation. Lake Ontario has many islands. Amherst Island, west of Kingston, 2 miles offshore. Population of 450, is recognized for its concentration of hawks and owls. Resident owls that live there would be the short-eared, the long-eared, and the great horned owl. And then there are many other species that overwinter: snowy owls, saw-whet owls, boreal owls, eastern screech owl, and the barred owl. Also, red-tailed hawks, rough-legged hawks, are usually present, along with annual sightings of bald eagles and peregrine falcons. And then I want to mention yet the Thousand Islands in Lake Ontario. They're at the far eastern part of Lake Ontario, beginning of the St. Lawrence River. Wolf Island is the largest of the Thousand Islands. In fact, there are 1,864 islands in the Thousand Islands. Wolf Island has a resident population of 1,400, covers 48 square miles, and it's also accessible by ferry from both Canada and the U.S. And I failed to mention that Pelee Island is also accessible from both Canada and the U.S. by ferry. One of these seasonal ferries is called Horns Ferry, It's been operating out of Cape Vincent, New York, from May through October, and was first licensed in 1802, and it's still operating by the descendants of the first license holder. Just a little trivia fact there. All right, thinking now about the ecology of the Great Lakes, and I'm leaning heavily on a book by Dan Egan, which is entitled The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. Lake trout used to be very plentiful in the Great Lakes until the 1940s. Lake Erie was an exception. It didn't have such a high lake trout population because Lake Erie is very shallow, and thus its waters were too warm for the trout. Lake Michigan's annual haul during the 1890s was more than 8 million pounds. Lake Superior, Lake Huron were similar, it's a little less. Lake Ontario was over 1 million pounds. And this fishing went on year after year, decade after decade, in those volumes, until about 1940, the trout population suddenly crashed. In 1944, Lake Michigan's trout haul was still 6.5 million pounds. In 1949, only 5 years later, it was a measly 342,000 pounds. And another 5 years, it was 0 pounds. Trout crashes also happened at the same time in Lake Huron, later in Lake Superior, and to a lesser extent in Lake Erie. It was a similar story for the whitefish. In 1947, the annual lake haul in Lake Michigan was 6 million pounds. 10 years later, 25,000 pounds. So what happened? Why the crash? Well, there was overfishing, that was part of it, but the biggest culprit was the sea lamprey. The sea lamprey is native to the coast rivers and streams of the East Coast. Researchers think they came up the Hudson River through the Erie Canal, which was completed in 1825, and that joined Hudson River to Lake Erie, and then down to New York. So they think they came up that river and through that canal system. And the feeder canals that fed that system came from Lake Ontario. So they got into Lake Ontario. And from there, they found their way up the Welland Canal into Lake Erie and then into Lake Huron, Lake Michigan, and Lake Superior. So sea lampreys are an eel-like creature. It's a parasite that latches onto its prey, and they grow up to about 2 feet long, weigh up to 1 pound, and they slowly kill their host by sucking its blood. Each sea lamprey can kill up to 40 pounds of fish during its life cycle of 12 to 18 months. A female can lay up to 100,000 eggs. Of those 100,000, about 1,000 will hatch. So sea lampreys were killing the fish. They were, and the trout populations just crashed. So this bothered biologists, and rightly so. And one man in particular, I didn't write his name down, he studied this, and he found a chemical in 1957 that killed the sea lamprey, but not the other fish. And so they started using this chemical, this lampricide, if you please, and started treating the feeder streams where these lamprey were going up to spawn, and treating them annually. And as a result of that, they were able to lower the lamprey population to about 10%. And it's remained there since 1967, about 10% of its high in 1957. So things are looking good. It got on top of the sea lampreys. But there was another invader. the alewives, they're called, commonly known as river herring. And they also are native to the East Coast. They grow up to 16 inches long, average 9.8 pounds, and typically they spend 3 to 4 years in the Atlantic Ocean and then migrate into freshwater streams and rivers to spawn. Now, the Great Lakes alewives only get about half the size of their Atlantic cousins, usually between 6 to 8 inches. They were first seen in Lake Ontario in 1873, and that didn't cause a problem immediately because their main predator, the Atlantic salmon and lake trout population, was still high. And so they were controlled. In 1931, they were found above the Niagara Falls in Lake Erie, in Lake Huron in 1933, in Lake Michigan in 1949, and Lake Superior in 1954. So the lake population was lake trout population was decimated by overfishing, by the lamprey invasion, and now here comes these little fish invaders with really no predators, and they multiplied. Their population exploded, especially in Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. In 1962, it was estimated that alewives made up 17% of the fish mass in Lake Michigan. 3 years later, that number was pegged at 90% alewives. And it was similar for Lake Huron, Lake Ontario. Not so high in Lake Superior because its waters are colder, and not as high in Lake Erie because its waters are warmer than they like, and also Lake Erie retain more predators. So these little fish, these alewives, outcompeted the native species for food, and they ate their young. And their numbers were astounding. One school measured 10 miles long and 60 feet thick. A 15-foot sphere of alewives was estimated to contain up to 6,000 fish. Boat propellers, and I quote, would churn the fish to the surface as if they were bubbles, end of quote. And then, in 1967, mass die-offs of alewives began. Suddenly they started dying. Whole schools consisting of billions of fish would die, and this would create a floating putrid mass that would demoralize any town where they happened to be on the road where they washed ashore. It caused a real problem. One of these slicks measured 7 miles long and 2/3 of a mile wide. Now, commercial fishermen reminiscing from those days, he still knew where a few fishing holes were. And so on the way to these fishing holes, as they're going out, he described the jolts from hitting midwater piles of dead alewives like hitting a snowbank. Now, what was the problem? Why were these fish suddenly dying? These fish are designed to live best in salt water. So they're living in fresh water, which caused their kidneys to work overtime because they were needed to be continually expelling this water that kept seeping into their cells. And at the same time, their bodies were trying to retain any salt that was present in the lake water. It was also discovered that their thyroids were stunted, likely due to a deficit of iodine in fresh water. Another stress was the sudden temperature changes up to 20 degrees Fahrenheit that would occur suddenly in the lake when winds would churn the water and the cold water from underneath would come up. And so it seemed that the combination of all these stresses caused these sudden massive die-offs. And it looked like this is going to continue. Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, Lake Ontario, they're doomed to these population booms and then die-offs. Well, there was another biologist that thought he had a good remedy. Howard Tanner became fishery chief in Michigan, Department of Conservation, and he saw this as an opportunity to turn the Great Lakes, especially Lake Michigan, into a sport fisherman's paradise. So he had the streams that fed into Lake Michigan stocked with coho salmon fry, which is a type of Pacific salmon. This was 1966. Coho salmon typically have a life cycle of 3 years. First 18 months they spend in streams where they're hatched, and the next 18 months in the oceans before returning to their home stream to spawn and die. But if conditions are right, they will grow faster, and some will return and spawn sooner. And that happened in Lake Michigan. In several months, they grew from being finger-sized to 7 pounds. And that was the typical coho size in the Pacific Ocean, its native habitat. Of the 1 million fish that were planted in April of 1966, several thousand returned to that fall to spawn. And the next fall, 1967, tens of thousands returned to their home streams to spawn. Many of these fish were 20 pounds or more. So Lake Michigan was prime salmon habitat. And the fishermen came. Retail sales in northern Michigan jumped by 11.9 million from 1966 to 1967 when the first salmon run occurred. And then in 1967, Michigan also began planting the Chinook salmon, which in their native habitat grew up to 100 pounds. But it turned out they only grew to about 40 pounds in the Great Lakes. So by the fall of 1967, Michigan biologists had planted nearly 2 million coho, 1 million Chinook, and 1 million lake trout in Lake Michigan's waters. And then State of Michigan, began supplying the other Great Lakes states with free salmon eggs. And by the next year, 1968, Pacific salmon were swimming in all five of the Great Lakes. And things went well for 30 years. Salmon ate the alewives, grew fast, and fishermen caught the salmon, and things were booming. Then, the salmon population crashed. For 30 years, salmon had been multiplying exponentially in the wild, and the biologists thought that natural reproduction only accounted for about 15% of Lake Huron salmon population. So they were planting 3.5 million salmon every year, only to realize too late, when they started tracking this, that the tables were turned, and as many as 16 million were being added to the population naturally every year. So, simply put, there weren't enough alewives to feed all the salmon. So biologists reduced their hatchery plantings, but the salmon numbers continued to dwindle. By 2010, the salmon harvest had crashed in Lake Huron. By 2014, it was evident that Lake Michigan's populations were going the same way. It turned out that the alewives, the salmon's food source, were being threatened from both ends of the food chain. Salmon were eating them from above, and their food source, plankton, was vanishing. Why was that? It's another invader, the zebra mussel. Zebra mussels are native to southern Russia and Ukrainian lakes. Adults are typically the size of a nickel, They have invaded most of Europe's waterways. They were first found in Lake St. Clair in 1988, 3,000 miles from the closest known colony. And they think they probably hitched a ride in a freighter's ballast tank. And then when it had to lighten up to go up through Lake St. Clair, got released into the water. Each female can produce 1 million eggs per year. These eggs hatch into microscopic offspring called veligers that are covered with little hairs that help them to catch the currents and swim to a new location during the first few weeks of their lives. These hairs also allow these veligers to catch food, and they begin to grow a shell, which eventually weighs them down, and then they sink, settle to the lake or river bottom, where they attach themselves to a hard surface, such as rocks, pilings, or even other mussels. Within a year, they are sending out puffs of their own veligers to establish new colonies. And they fix themselves to a hard surface by excreting plaque from a gland in their foot. Then this gland excretes proteins that trickle down the foot and fuse with the plaque, creating a cement-like bond as durable as epoxy. So they are very hard to get off once they're on. Zebra mussels are filter feeders, and each mussel filters about 1 liter of water per day, sequestering the nutrients into its shell. So they're filtering the water, and then they're hanging on to these nutrients in their shell. By the end of 1989, so it was 1988, they found them in Lake St. Clair. By the end of 1989, these zebra mussels were found all across the Great Lakes, and they have no real main predators. Now, there are fish that feed on them. I found it interesting that whitefish, especially Lakes Michigan and Huron, are adapting to, because of their food source, otherwise it's gone, they're actually eating these mussels. And another invader, the goby. Goby fish only, it's just a small fish, also from the Caspian Sea, that eats mussels, and they become very plentiful in the Great Lakes. But they didn't really have any natural predators, and their densities can exceed 100,000 per square meter. So in addition to the ecological damage they cause, they also have cost industries and cities billions of dollars over the last 30 years, inventing and maintaining treatment systems for their intake and discharge pipes. One estimate I read pegged it at costing industries across the Great Lakes about $500 million each year. On the tail of the zebra mussels came the quagga mussels, Q-U-A-G-G-A, and they are related to the zebra mussel, only they're much worse. A zebra mussel's depth tolerance is 60 feet, a quagga mussel's depth tolerance is 400 or up to 540 feet. And quagga mussels don't require a hard surface to latch onto, like the zebra, so they can blanket entire lake bottoms. And they filter nutrients out of the water year-round. Zebras only feed during the warmer months. In 1992, 3 years after they were found in Lake Michigan, zebras made up more than 98% of the invasive mussel population. By 2005, the quaggas made up 97.7% of its invasive mussel population. The impacts have been similar in Lake Ontario and Lake Huron. Lake Superior lacks the calcium mussels need to thrive, so it doesn't have so many. Why does this matter? Under some conditions, these mussels can filter all Lake Michigan in 2 weeks. And this has made its waters some of the clearest in the world. In the 1980s, a Secchi disk reading was about 20 feet in Lake Michigan. Now, a Secchi disk is simply a round disk, about 8 inches in diameter, divided into quarters, two black and two white, across from each other. And they simply lower that disk down into the water by a rope, and when you can no longer see the disk, that's the Secchi reading. So it was 20 feet in 1980s. By 2010, the Secchi reading was over 100 feet. So these mollusks, these mussels, are filtering the water to such an extent that it's allowing the sunlight to penetrate deeper. And clear water allows a nuisance seaweed-like plant to thrive, which is called Cladophora, which is actually a green algae. So Cladophora need sunlight, they need nutrients, and a hard surface to thrive, and the mussels provide all three for them. When it breaks off, this Cladophora will wash ashore along with the mussels that it has attached to, and it rots. The septic smelling muck can get shin deep along the shorelines. The decomposing Cladophora burns up massive amounts of oxygen, and this has opened the door to botulism, or a botulism-causing bacteria, which thrive in oxygen-starved environments. Botulism is deadly. It causes acute food poisoning, which is characterized by muscle weakness, paralysis, disturbances of vision, swallowing, and speech, and a high mortality rate. So biologists think that these invasive mussels are sucking up this bacteria and are in turn eaten by gobies, little fish. And this poison, the poison gobies then become paralyzed and are easy prey for birds. And the birds die. It's estimated that over 100,000 birds, including bald eagles, great blue herons, ducks, loons, terns, and plovers, have died since 1999 due to botulism outbreaks. Toxic algae blooms. An algae bloom is simply a rapid increase in algae population. And a toxic blue-green algae called Microcystis is toxic. The shallow waters of Lake Erie, Western Lake Erie especially, are notorious for these outbreaks. And you have a picture of in your handout here. There, in 2011, Lake Erie experienced the worst algae bloom in decades. Nearly 2,000 square miles of open water were smothered. In places, I quote, the algae was nearly 4 inches deep and so mucousy it strained the motor of boats that tried to plow through it. Now, it turns out that the reason for these algae blooms, the culprit for that is too much phosphorus running off into the lake. And agriculture is the biggest culprit caused by fertilizer runoff from the fields. So these blooms, consequently, can be forecast months in advance based on how much rain fell in the spring and if that rain fell before the phosphorus was absorbed by the crops. So why is this a problem? So if we have all these mussels that are filtering the water, trillions of them around the clock, it turns out that these mussels are selective feeders. If they take in any toxic algae, they quickly spit it out again. And so they're just feeding on the good algae, which leaves, it's highly probable that if you have an algae bloom, it's going to be toxic. Well, I was going to talk about weather. You have some tables there that I took from Illinois State Water Survey by Robert W. Scott and Floyd A. Huff. I'll just say this, the Great Lakes exert considerable influence on the climate within an 80-kilometer zone around them. Much of this difference is due to the differences in heat capacities between land and water, and to the large source of moisture that lakes provide to the lower atmosphere. So I don't know if you can, those tables maybe aren't real self-explanatory, but it is showing how the Great Lakes affect precipitation, how they affect temperature, how they affect the cloud cover and vapor pressure, of the areas surrounding the Great Lakes. Precipitation obviously is very largely affected, especially by the prevailing winds. You have a diagram there of different winds and how that causes lake effect snow. I should maybe talk about lake effect snow yet for a little bit. A short answer for what causes lake effect snow is that it forms when cold freezing air passes over a lake's warmer waters. This causes the lake water to evaporate and to warm the air, and that moist air then moves away from the lake. After cooling, it dumps its moisture on the ground, potentially becoming snow. Elevation also specifically, or that effect is enhanced by elevation on the downwind shore. So that can produce a greater uplift, which can produce narrow but intense bands of snow. And then the lake, in order for lake effect rain or snow to fall, the air moving across the lake must be 13 degrees Celsius lower at an altitude where the air pressure is 85 kilopascals. And that's about 5,000 feet above the surface. So there must be that 13 degree temperature difference, which allows the vigorous heat and moisture transportation vertically. And also a fetch, or a distance of at least 100 miles that the wind can blow across open water, is required to produce lake effect snow. Record snowfalls. Houghton, Marquette, Munising cities in Michigan's Upper Peninsula typically receive 250 to 300 inches of snow each season. The Keweenaw Peninsula of Upper Michigan, which juts in the Lake Superior, has records of 390 inches of snow or more set there. And then I'll just give one more here. Between December 24 and December 28, 2001, Buffalo, New York received 82.3 inches of snow, and some of you may remember that. In conclusion, I'm just going to read a few verses yet again from Psalm 107. They that go down to the sea in ships, that do business in great waters, these see the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep. For he commandeth and raiseth the stormy wind, which lifteth up the waves thereof. They mount up to the heaven, they go down again to the depths. Their soul is melted because of trouble. They reel to and fro and stagger like a drunken man and are at their wit's end. Then they cry unto the Lord in their trouble, and he bringeth them out of their distresses. He maketh the storm a calm, so that the waves thereof are still.